House Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs, Friday, April 29th. Public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2793. Work session on 2206, 2864, and 2848.
Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs come to order. Clerk, note the members present. Those absent are excused. We have the first bill before us, House Bill 2206. Joyce?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that had to be pulled back from the floor because the amendments had a technical error. You'll see proposed House Bill 2206-2 amendments in your file.
Yeah.
Those correct the printed amendments, which are also in your file. The error is in line 4 of the printed amendments where it says subsections 2, 3, and 4. It should say 2, 4, and 5.
Okay. Okay, Morgan.
Mr. Chair.
Limson.
I move we adopt HB 2206-2 amendments to the April 20th printed bill.
Okay, any discussion? Any objections? So moved.
Mr. Chair, move the bill to the 2206 to the floor.
Okay. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Who carried that?
Chuck.
Representative Jones.
Go to the next one, please.
Representative Lindquist.
Aye.
Representative Hanlon.
Aye.
Representative Jones.
Aye.
Representative
DeBoer?
Aye.
Representative
Reichen? All right. Chuck Bennett, the last
Representative Bennett carried that.
Representative Bennett, okay. Next bill is House Bill 2864. All right.
Good deal. Again, Mr. Chairman, there's an error in the printed amendments. The error is on the very last page of the printed amendments where it says, last line, where it says delete section 2 and insert sections 2 and 3, it should say 1 and 2, sections 1 and 2.
Okay. Yeah.
I make the motion.
Yes.
Go ahead, Rob. I move that we amend 2864 with the amendments noted as Legislative Council Draft 2864-3.
Okay. Discussion? Any objection?
No.
Move to send it to the floor as amended.
That's a due pass. Okay.
With due pass.
Discussion?
No. Nope.
Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Hanlon?
Aye.
Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Lindquist?
Aye.
Representative DeBoer?
Aye.
Representative
Reichen? Aye. Motion passed. Who carried that?
Representative Lindquist carried that.
Representative Lindquist carried the bill again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right again.
Third bill that we have before us now is the House Bill 2848.
Oh, boy. Mr. Chairman, this is the auctioneer's bill that you appointed a subcommittee consisting of Representatives Hanlon and Lindquist and Jones to work on. They've come up with a set of amendments. I provided you with some information yesterday that outlines the amendments, and you have a hand-amended bill in your file.
Okay. Is there anybody signed on yesterday?
No. You want to ask any questions for somebody?
Mr. Chair, you want me to report on this?
Yes.
The subcommittee met Representative Jones and Representative Lindquist and myself. Basically, what we did was we took the original bill as printed, took some of the substantive provisions out of it. There is no longer a board or administrative agency type body involved, and we inserted those substantive provisions of the bill as delineated by Joyce Thorbeck in her April 29th letter into the unfair trade practices law of the state of Oregon. And for a quick summary, that's the part of the law where if these substantive provisions are violated, the Attorney General has the power to go in and stop the violations, or one may employ a private lawyer, and if successful, has some more favorable than general provisions on recovery. That's a succinct summary of what our subcommittee did.
And
we have legislative counsel here, and we directed Brad to draw the bill and present it based on our subcommittee.
I just want to ask.
But that's what it gets.
Of Tom, maybe. Representative Hamlin. And everyone agreed on it. All the parties involved were supportive of it.
We heard no disagreement. That night, and there appeared to be both proponents and opponents of the original bill present at that time.
Okay.
Matt, do you want to add something to that?
I'm here to answer any questions. For the record, my name is Brad Swank, and I'm a deputy legislative counsel. I suppose I can explain the bill very simply and what it's done and the way that it's laid out. Basically, what I've done at the direction of the subcommittee that you formed was to take the provisions that they were interested in out of the current bill, and I basically rewrote it. In section one of the amendments, you'll find that I retained the definitions for auction, auctioneer, and auction mart. In section two, I made amendments to RS 698-640 that would put in that section all of the provisions relating to the trade practices that they wanted to control in auctions. In Section 3, I amended a provision of the Uniform Commercial Code to remove the contradictory provision and to refer to this provision dealing with reserve bidding. And in Section 4, I made Section 4 is put in to make the practices that they described relating to auctions subject to enforcement under the Unfair Trade Practices Act. So basically, the section that you're talking about in terms of the bidding practices and requirements for auctioneers and auction mart owners are the provisions that are in Section 2 of the amendments to RS 698-640. And in that section, the first portion I put in, I'm looking at the hand-engrossed bill. I assume that you all have copies of it. The first portion of the section that I put in is sort of informational. It says what this section does. It says that the requirements are in addition to any provisions relating to auctions under the Uniform Commercial Code. I sort of put that in as a reference so people can find out where in the Uniform Commercial Code they need to go to find out certain things about bidding. It describes where in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act this is subjected to those provisions and the enforcement provisions that apply. On page one of your hand-engrossed bill, lines 22, 23, and 24, the language that's not underlined is the current language that's in ORS 698-640, so that's a current requirement by law, and the subcommittee asked me to retain that. The subsequent provisions running from lines 25 through 27 on the first page, the entire second page and lines 1 through 6 on the third page are the new provisions that they asked me to include that would restrict various practices at auctions. And I can go through those individually if you feel it would be helpful.
I would.
Okay. The existing language, I'll talk about that first. Subsection 1 of what would be 698-640 on your hand-engrossed bill, it's page 1, lines 22 through 24, requires that any advertisement of an auction sale must include the name of the auctioneer who will conduct the auction sale or the person responsible for the conduct of the auction sale. The second subsection, which would be new language, prohibits an auctioneer from conducting an auction, who is conducting an auction, and the operator of an auction mart from bidding on or offering to buy any property at the auction. The third subsection requires an auctioneer or the operator, prohibits an auctioneer or auction mart operator from using any method of bidding at an auction that will allow the property to be purchased on behalf of the auctioneer or auction mart operator. Subsection 4 deals with what is called basically reserve bidding, and it prohibits an auctioneer or auction mart operator from using any method of bidding at an auction that allows the auctioneer or auction mart operator to avoid selling any property offered for sale at the auction. So they can't establish a price and say, you have to reach this price or we won't sell it, unless, and it establishes exemptions, unless the advertisements before the auction indicate that there will be some kind of reserve or minimum price, and the property that has a minimum price is clearly indicated at the time of auction. Basically, it makes the presumption that if you don't hear the auctioneer saying, we've got a minimum price on this, then there is no minimum price. And it has to be in the advertisements. Subsection 5 limits the ability of the auctioneer or the auction mart operator to employ what is called in the trade, I believe, a shill. There were other various terms that were used at the subcommittee meeting, but it prohibits the auctioneer or auction mart operator from employing or using a shill on behalf of the auctioneer or auction mart operator to act as a buyer at the auction. I've had some discussions with your LA about this particular section. Subsection 6 places requirements on an auctioneer and auction mart operator in terms of what they can do with money they receive that are owed, and there is a misspelling on line 19 of page 2 that it says owned to a client, it should be owed. It's a typographical error. If an auctioneer or auction mart owner owes money to a client from the sale of the client's goods, they must comply with the following, with the provisions in this subsection if the money is not immediately paid to the client at the time of the auction. And that is, they must maintain the money in a separate account. They have to account to the customer or client as to what they've done with the money and how the money has been spent. And the third thing they have to do is pay the client before the end of 21 calendar days after the auction, unless they've made some other mutually agreed upon terms in writing. And those are basically the provisions that they wanted me to put in. Are there any questions?
Questions from Brad?
Yes. Can we go back up to page 2, line 16, where it talks about Joyce, is that the section you were referring to when we were talking earlier today?
About changing buyer to bidder?
Mm-hmm.
That's the section we were talking about. I'm not really sure there's a difference. I'm not sure it matters.
Well, this says to act as a buyer. Arguably, a person wouldn't act as a buyer if they didn't actually buy something. The term bidder might be, from what Ms. Thorbeck and I talked about, it might be better if you use the term bidder, because that would, if somebody didn't buy something, but if they were bidding, it would still cover that portion of being a shell. And somebody that's there not really to buy, but just to drive up the prices by bidding.
Yeah, that's fine. Did Mark? Did you discuss that with Mark?
Yes.
Joyce, did you discuss
that? Yes, I did. He thought either word would be all right.
Okay. May I suggest that we insert where those buyers appear, just bidder or buyer?
Yeah.
Would that complicate your language?
No, not particularly. Okay.
Bidder or buyer.
Bidder or buyer.
Bidder or buyer.
Okay. First question from Brad. George,
I
don't
have
that.
No, I
don't have a
question.
Okay, fine.
No, I was there.
Okay, so. Anyone want to ask more questions or not? No? Not necessarily. Mark, do you want to comment on those amendments?
Yes. Chairman, members of the committee, to be very short, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent the Oregon Auctioneers Association. The association, since that committee meeting, has met and has voted to support the board of directors, support the concepts in these amendments. As you know, we felt very strongly that a commission was needed. The committee has determined that they did not want to go that far, and that this was one way to try to get to what we believe are some of the problems in the marketplace, and we do support the amendments.
Okay. No questions. Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we amend House Bill 2848 by adopting the proposed 2848-1 amendments and add thereto on page
two
the correct spelling on line 9 of owed rather than owned, and additionally page 2, line 19, and additionally on line 16, insert between A and buyer, bidder or buyer, and if the term buyer appears throughout this bill elsewhere, that the same amendment be made.
Okay. Any discussion? Any objections? Motion passed.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2848 to the floor with it as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Boyle.
I'd just like to thank Representative Hanlon and the subcommittee members for taking a very, what would have been a negative bill for us on the House floor and turning it to a very positive thing that I think a lot of people on the House can vote for. Thank you.
I also want to thank the subcommittee for doing that. I think they did a good job.
Mr. Chairman, may I be heard?
Yes, sir. Actually, it's not a usual thing that we do that, but please come forward and make a statement, if you can do it shortly.
I'm Claude Kilgore, representing myself and 67 other auctioneers in the state of Oregon, and 28 auction yard owners and operators, and 45 others that work in the business. The amendment to House Bill 2848 has only been available for the past 15 minutes to the people in our industry. And I will ask that you do not act on passing it until the people in our industry have had the opportunity to look it over and make recommendations.
I thought of the subcommittee when they worked on the amendments that there were people, Representative Hanlon.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kilgore and others were representing the auctioneers on both sides of the issues of the original bill, were present at the subcommittee meeting. What the subcommittee did was it took the original bill, it had legislative council present, and it went through each provision in the original bill that was substantive piece by piece and directed that legislative council specifically draw the bill that we have before us today in accordance with our wishes and direction that night. And Mr. Kilgore was there. He may be technically correct that the actual amendments haven't been available as finally printed until today. But I'm certain the provisions were
concept.
Mr. Chairman,
were there.
There is a great deal of difference in what you hear in a subcommittee hearing and the recommendations that will go back to the committee and what comes from legislative council's pen. And I see a considerable exaggeration and increase over what the subcommittee recommended, and I've not had the opportunity to analyze how it affects our industry. And I think that we should be permitted that time to determine what will happen under this amendment if it's passed, under this bill if it's passed, as amended.
But, Mr. Kilgore, again, if you were present when Legislative Council and the subcommittee went through the bill section by section, And I don't think there's no need to review it, because that's the way it came out of, it was discussed, you know, on that subcommittee hearing.
Mr. Chairman, this was not available to the people in our industry until 15 or 20 minutes ago. And it is not a complete representation of what came out of the subcommittee hearing.
Well, I can advise you this then. If you would look over those amendments and you see that there are certain items in the amendments that you think were not completely correct to what you have heard on that subcommittee meeting, you can address it on the other side, on the Senate side, what we want to act on this bill today.
I would be very interested in doing that to this committee, sir. This committee is already acquainted with this bill.
Chairman.
Representative Jones.
I might add for Mr. Kilgore's own knowledge, the committee itself has not seen these until today either. The point, though, is that these do represent the requests made by the committee to Legislative Council, and in reviewing them in this brief period of time, I feel very comfortable that what we asked for we have today, and I feel comfortable that we could go ahead and move it out of the committee, because there are many, many bills that must be reviewed in order to get
I would suggest to you that no law is better than bad law. We in our industry have considerable ethics, and most of the things that are contained in this amendment we practice anyway. But there could be some things in there that are not to the public's benefit or to our benefit, and I see that the time of a week or two to review it and to bring it back to committee would not be wasted time. It would be time well spent.
Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, that's not the way the system works. We're down to a timeline now, where if we waited for a week or two for you to review this bill would never happen, because our committees are under a timeline to close down and to move House bills, and the most a committee person has usually to see amendments. It's not unusual what we're doing today at all. It happens a lot of times, and there's just not 2 weeks to wait. I'm sorry, but that's the way that is, simply.
When you're passing law, it would appear to me that you don't know how it will affect the industry or the public. It's better to table it than to pass bad law.
We don't want to argue that, Mr. Gilgore. Thank you for your appearance here for the committee. Representative Hanley.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion to move it to the floor and would like to place another motion. I move that we further amend HB 2848 by deleting it, page 1, line 2, the last 3 words, and appropriating money.
Okay. Discussion? No. Any objections? No. Motion passed.
Mr. Chair, I move.
Before you
do,
one question.
Excuse me.
Does the summary automatically get changed?
In theory.
Yeah. It does. Okay.
Yeah, conceptually.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2848 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bennett?
Aye.
Representative Hanlon?
Aye.
Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Lindquist?
Aye.
Representative DeBoer?
Aye.
Representative Reichen?
Aye. Motion passed. Representative Hanlon, you want to carry the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We now have before us House Bill 2793.
Thank you, Bill.
Josh, where are we on that bill?
Thank you.
We have two different sets of proposed amendments to this bill. Mr. Chairman, I gave them to each of you in a memo yesterday and explained the differences between the two. One set is sponsored by Mr. Campbell, and the other set it's my understanding has been agreed to by the auto dealers and manufacturers, and Osberg is here today. I'm not sure what their position is on the two amendments. Let's get them first.
Rich Kiesa? Which complaint?
They're included in here.
The dash six amendments are the ones.
Mr. Austin is in the building, Mr. Chairman, but evidently stepped out of the room for a moment.
Why don't you go over the amendments, Rich?
Rich Keister, for the record, with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Amendment number six, dated 42583, is as a result of further conversations and discussions with Osberg and Dieselgate. You had before you the last hearing proposed amendments dated, or I don't know if it's called a date, but it was dash four. The first change is a rewrite by Legislative Council of Section 2, which did not change substantive change, but just a rewording of that section. And on line 17, the word all was removed. Page 2, line 6, on collateral charges, the words excluding interest were inserted. Page 2, line 14, the word substantially was inserted. And on the last change, Mr. Chairman.
914, substantially.
Okay.
Where were we? The last change is on page 3, section 6. The change is from 6 months to 1 year. Line 20.
Oh, line 20 there?
Yes.
Second. Questions for Ray? Any questions, Ray? Representative.
These were agreed to by who?
The Manufacturers Association, the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and as far as they go, by the Osberg and by Mr. Campbell at Dieselgate. Okay. However, I want to be sure you understand that there were some areas still of disagreement that Mr. Campbell has submitted amendments to the committee.
Can I? Have you come to the best possible compromise so far as what you and Mr. Campbell and Osberg are going to come to? And do these two sets of amendments that we have here today, the differences between them reflect the irrevocable differences between your points of view?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I believe the answer to that is a definite yes. We have spent 8 to 10 hours in negotiations. I feel I've been in the middle of this situation, trying to bring the manufacturers and the consumer groups together. We have a bill, I believe, in Amendments Dash 6 that we can live with, the manufacturers can live with, and quite frankly, I believe it solves the consumer interest problems as they perceive them.
Further questions for me? No? Okay, Rick, thank you. Thank you, Rick. John Steuben for?
Good afternoon, Chairman Reichen, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to again testify before the House Business and Consumer Affairs Committee. With me today is Nivette Bowen, a student at Willamette University and a member of the Board of Directors of OSPIRG. For the record, my name is John Steubenval. I'm an organizer and the acting director of the Oregon Student Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. OSPIRG is a student-directed, student-funded organization dedicated to consumer protection, environmental preservation, good government, and social justice in Oregon. OSPIRG believes that HB 2793, as originally written, is in need of revision. We therefore fully support HB 2793-7 as now presented. In this testimony, I would like to briefly address three specific points which OSPIRG feels are of particular importance.
Sir, may I interrupt you here? I think we heard testimony before. What we want to know is how you comment on the proposed amendments by the industry.
Yeah, Chairman Reichen, I'll address that in my testimony.
Representative. Before you, I just need...
English.
Okay, you just said now that you support that...
Reference to reasonable allowance for use, as I read the bill, applies, as I read it, to the case when the vehicle is returned, not when it's replaced. I'm not sure how you provide for compensation for reasonable use in the case of replacement. But if you note in subsection B, beginning on line 4, page 2, you accept return of the vehicle, you refund the full purchase price, including certain costs, less a reasonable allowance for the consumer's use of the vehicle. And under subsection 2 deals with refunds. It doesn't refer to replacement. Now, if you want some kind of provision for reasonable allowance for in the case of replacement, I think that could well be specifically addressed.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Hanlon, Jones first. And then.
I think in referring to counsel's comments, when we're talking about a comparable new and unused motor vehicle, if in fact it was determined that a replacement should be made in the arbitration process, then in the wording that you have, if the vehicle had been used for 11,000 miles,
right,
for example, there would be no provision with the wording that you have for anything to be determined regarding that usage if the replacement was determined. Correct?
No.
I mean, that's what you're attempting. Is that
right.
Correct?
If I may.
Go ahead.
What we looked at with the language with options A and B, line 3 and line 4, is we envisioned that exact scenario. The scenario being if a consumer purchases a new motor vehicle and drives that motor vehicle for 20 miles and it becomes defective, then we believe the consumer should have recourse under option A, the replacement of the motor vehicle. However, if the consumer buys that new motor vehicle and drives it for 11,000 miles, as you said, then, as I tried to indicate in my testimony, we feel it's unfair for the manufacturer to have to replace with that defective motor vehicle with a comparable new motor vehicle. That's where option B would come in, whereas the arbitration process could award to the consumer a refund of the purchase price plus collateral charges less the reasonable amount for usage for that 11,000 miles. See, all this would come into play under that third-party arbitration process.
Let me back up a minute, if I may. The determining factor as to which of these is going to be the remedy is, I believe, with the arbitration committee. It is not with the manufacturer.
Yes, that's correct.
Totally, or yes. With the consumer totally.
Yes, that's
is that correct.
Correct? Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So what you're saying is, if in fact the arbitration decision is that it should be replaced, and it has 11,000 miles on it.
Right.
Prior to it having any defect acknowledged, then you would see that option being closed to the arbitration group so that they had to replace that vehicle with a new car and not any other kind of vehicle.
Right. Again, this...
Even though the usage had already been there.
Yes, but again the scenario that we anticipate is that since the arbitration process is totally unbiased either way, we had envisioned that in that scenario where the motor vehicle had incurred substantial use and mileage, the arbitration process would rule that it's more just to refund the purchase price less the allowance for the use of the vehicle.
Okay, so you don't want them to have the option in those kinds of cases as far as replacing it with a comparable vehicle unless it is a brand new vehicle. That's what you're attempting to do in this. If they replace it, then it must be a brand new vehicle, even if it had usage.
Yes. But again.
So you're narrowing the options available to the arbitration panel.
No, the way I understand it, the arbitration panel, in a case where a vehicle has incurred substantial use, that arbitration panel would rule, more than likely, would rule not to replace the car, but rather to refund the purchase price less the reasonable amount for usage. Again, given that the arbitration panel is balancing the interests of the manufacturers and the consumers.
But what I said was that you're narrowing the options available to them by changing the wording to comparable, new, and unused. Correct? I know they're unbiased, and I don't, you know,
right,
the party
right, I understand
has
that.
Control.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Capis.
I guess I'm not sure I read it the same way you do, but my question is, yeah, who's going to explain this all to the arbitration panel? That explains, because as I read it, it says that the manufacturer shall replace the motor vehicle or accept the return. And who's going to tell the manufacturer that if a vehicle has 5,000 miles of usage, then they have to return the car? They can't accept the new car or whatever. Are there going to be rules written up that outline how this is all going to be to actually work?
Right. Those kind of decisions would be left up to the arbitration panel on a case-by-case basis.
But who's going to tell them how they decide which option to take? If you read the law, mm-hmm, and just read it for what it says, there's nothing in there that says, in this type of a circumstance, these are your options, or these are not your options. And it, to me, you know, maybe I'm missing something, but I don't see anything that tells them that this is what they're going to do in sorts of circumstances.
I'm not sure I understand your question, mm-hmm, frankly. Possibly.
Well, Lou, do you understand what I'm saying, Lou?
I think so. What you're saying is that what I understand is Section 5 says that you have to go to...
What the gentleman from Osprey is saying is that this procedure, right from Section 1 on, deals totally with the arbitration process. Okay.
Yep.
Section 5 says this is the procedure only if the dealer participates under that.
Mm-hmm.
And if it goes to arbitration, who is going to explain all this to the arbitrator of exactly what this really means?
Well, this does, Section 5 does say that the remedy under Section 3 is available to the consumer who uses the, has complied with the other provisions and has engaged in the informal dispute settlement procedure. And it seems, if I'm understanding, it seems as if what you're what we may be looking for is a closer tie between Section 5 and Section 3, something to telling the panel, the arbitration panel, that the remedies it has available are those under Section 3.
No, what I'm saying is, he explained that if a car has 20 miles on it, obviously it's either going to be replaced with a brand new car or they're going to get their money back totally.
Yes.
Less 20 miles times 10 cents or whatever it is. If a car has 20,000 miles on it, there's nothing in this bill. He said then, am I right, if it has 20,000 miles on it, what happens? They don't have the chance to get the new car.
No,
they
I'm
then
sorry.
Have to get their money returned.
Oh, that's true. What I tried to convey was that the arbitration process, in all likelihood, would rule that in the case with a defective new motor vehicle with 20,000 miles, it would be a more just settlement to refund the purchase price less the usage for 20,000 miles. That's the purpose of that arbitration process.
Mr.
Representative
Lindquist, then you were asking what guarantees that the panel will decide to resolve the dispute in that manner.
No, never mind. That's okay.
May I see if I can ask him what you're asking?
She
is asking, where are there criteria by which the arbitration panel will decide whether to exercise option A or option B here?
Okay, fine. I guess I was asking that.
Thank you, Jerry.
There are no criteria.
Okay.
It's certainly within the realm of possibility that if a car has 20,000 miles on it, that the arbitration panel, there's nothing to prohibit the arbitration panel from saying, give that consumer a new car.
Okay. Representative Jones.
One last little thought. I'm thinking in terms of the consumer. Okay?
Good for you.
I have a vehicle, and the arbitration panel has determined, because it has been determined to be defective and needs to either be replaced or refund because it is not repairable.
Yes.
Okay? The arbitration panel, let's say this car is now, after all this process, 2 years old almost. I have one choice left to me. Either they give me a brand new automobile, or they give me a refund and deduct the amount of usage that has been determined was there prior to the determination of the defect. I might want a 6-month-old demonstrator model instead of a refund.
Mm-hmm.
And the arbitration panel, if we use the wording that you have, would not have that option available to me as a consumer. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would reply to that by saying I don't see that under the language of the current amendments, I don't think it would be possible for there to be a 2-year-old motor vehicle that would be eligible under the language of the bill.
Say 18 months then, because if this happens anytime up to 12,000 miles or 1 year, right?
Whichever comes first.
Okay,
right.
Let's say it's a year, and by the time you go through the process, let's say it's 18 months old.
Uh-huh.
You understand what I'm saying? You're saying in your proposed amendment, that would close that option to the arbitration panel, and maybe to me as a consumer, because I might rather have a vehicle than the money.
Uh-huh. No, I understand that. In that case, you would have the option of having the purchase price refunded to you, at which point you could go out and buy a six-month-old vehicle.
And try.
Yeah, certainly. Well, certainly.
Okay. My point is, I think the option is
right.
Closed by that.
We have to go on this bill, so we have four more people to testify. This is a work session, and I think we allow for each of the four remaining persons here 5 minutes each to testify, and we then will take action on the bill, because Osberg wants the bill, but you want a bill that is passable on the floor also. That is what we have to keep in mind if we get a bill out of this committee. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You stay around. Maybe that we need. You can.
You don't have to.
You don't have to sit there. Ms. Mel Campbell?
Chairman,
why did you come up?
I'd like to bring Mr. Byrne up.
Okay, fine.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm an attorney in Portland, and I've handled, and my firm has handled, a number of a couple class actions against manufacturers. And we handle securities cases and antitrust cases and class actions as a rule. We do not handle, and we have always refused to handle, one-on-one problems where a person has a defective car, because really the remedies are not there under the present law. And I would like to speak to a number of things, a number of changes, which I think would be appropriate in number six, and I think a lot of these changes are in proposal number seven. And just to preface my remarks, I think that both number six and number seven are basically...
Yeah, why don't you take number six so we can follow you easier, and then...
I think that both of them are fairly good, except that I think it is critical, and you see this every time there's a dispute, whether or not it goes to a lawsuit, the law be very clear as to what the standards are. Because in the long run, that saves everybody money, the manufacturer and the consumer. And I think particularly in this kind of situation, it'll save the dealers money, because the dealers are caught in the middle. And the thing that this bill does is require the manufacturer to do things to take care of the consumer, and the dealer then is really out of it. So if this bill gives the consumer clear remedies against the manufacturer, I think it's going to be good for the consumer and for the dealer. Now, first, in the first thing that we were talking about, and that you were just talking about, in terms of what standards should the arbitration panel use, the bill specifically refers to the federal regulations under the Magnuson-Moss Act. And those regulations themselves contain standards as to what the arbitration panel should look at. And I can even send the committee copies of that, or legislative counsel can. But the arbitration panel can provide, in effect, a fair remedy, which can include refunds, replacement vehicles, and really anything in between as is appropriate in that particular case. But the importance of using the term new and unused vehicle, and that would be on line 3 on page 2, is what you don't want to have happen is the manufacturer come in and say, okay, now you have 3,000 miles on this car, it's obviously a lemon, and I'm just going to give you another car with 3,000 miles on it that somebody else traded in. Because the way this reads now, it says a comparable motor vehicle. So if you're turning in a lemon with 3,000 miles and cigarette burns on the upholstery, well, he'll give you another one with, you know, similar mileage and similar problems. You're getting somebody else's used car. So what the importance of putting in the word...
Lieutenant Bennett, excuse me. Lieutenant Bennett.
Could I ask you there on line 3, could that read just new without the and unused?
I think instead of comparable, I think that would be fine, a new motor vehicle. I think that would take care of the situation. Because if the manufacturer comes in, it's just like returning a blender or a toaster. I mean, you take that back and they can give you your money back, or they can give you a new toaster. You don't get somebody else's toaster with a bunch of crumbs that just happens to work when yours didn't. So I think this does the same thing, and it gives an option there of either replace it or you refund the money. Now, the next thing that I think is important is on line 6, on page 2, this excluding interest. The way the bill came out, and I think in the prior version, was it just said collateral charges and made no reference to interest. But I think here's the situation you would have. When somebody buys a car, many of their initial payments are going to be exclusively for interest, with just a little bit on principal, because the great majority of cars are financed. And the finance company is often associated with the manufacturer, GMAC or Ford Motor Credit or whatever. So you have a situation where somebody has paid considerable interest expense on the car. It turns out to be a lemon, and they can't get that money back, even though the manufacturers had the use of the money while the consumers had this lemon. So I think it's, I think the words excluding interest should be deleted. And the consumer should get back what he or she has paid for the car. And that's the consumer gets all the money back, the manufacturer gets the car back, and everybody's where they were to begin with. It's not the consumer's fault that the car was a lemon. Now, on the reasonable allowance for use, on page 2, line 9, I think that should be defined in more detail. And the problem is, what do you give as a credit or a deduction for mileage? Because I think the panel or the court, if it should get that far, has to have a standard. Because when you get, in my typewritten testimony, I gave an example. If you have a car that has, you know, say 5,000 miles on it, and the court's going to award 20 cents or 25 cents a mile, it could be that the consumer doesn't get enough money back to buy another car. And if the car has been a lemon to begin with, the mileage really has not been that valuable to the consumer. And I think something like 8 cents a mile would be fair. And what we did there was take a car that's going to go 100,000 miles, the average, and just divide that into the average cost of a car, and you're paying basically 8 cents for every good mile if it's a good car that's going to go 100,000 miles, as some courts have held cars should do. Now, on line 18 on page 2, and I have recommended that the word conclusive or conclusively presumed be inserted there between shall be and presumed. And the reason for this is simply to keep down the cost to everybody. Because if you just say presumed, that might mean that the manufacturer can go into the arbitration or to court and start fighting over whether it should be conclusively presumed or whether they can rebut that presumption. And you get into a fairly technical legal area there, because the person can come in and say, the car's broken down 4 times and they haven't fixed it, I should get my money back. Then the manufacturer can come in and start haggling over that. But if you say conclusive, I think that fulfills the meaning of the statute, that if you have the 30 days out of use or the 4 times, then the person gets their money back or a new car.
Mr. Byrne, I noticed, you know, you discuss this now, but actually those are the items that OSPR already agreed on, so we start hashing it all over again. That we don't want to do. We want to go from where OSPR has agreed.
I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I know Mr. Campbell was there.
Because the differences that they brought up is on page 2, line 2, or line 3, where they put new motor, comparable new motor vehicle. That is one. And second was on line 18. Let me see what else it may.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
It may be that Mr. Campbell and Osberg are separate individuals, too. I don't know.
Well, I can clarify this. Ike Osberg had 3 main points worthy, because we've worked with them, and I work with Mr. Campbell on this. But the things I'm talking about, I think, are fairly technical that don't really change the meaning, but would make it a clearer bill so the cases can get resolved more easily. I don't know that the manufacturers even would dispute some of these things, or the dealers. But these are things that would make it, what you don't want to, I think the, one of the present problems is the laws are all over the place. And you have this car which is no good, and the person doesn't know if he can get a refund, he doesn't know if he can get a new car, the manufacturer doesn't know what's going to happen if there's a lawsuit. So the beauty of this is that it presents the standard very clearly, and what you don't want to have happen is to have to go to court to decide if what this word presume means, or to go to court to decide what a reasonable allowance is. If you just put that in the bill, then it's clear to everybody to begin with. So,
Representative Jones.
Can you tell me how this compares with the California law that has been passed?
I don't know
in relationship to the proposed amendments?
I don't know the answer to that.
Do you know how it compares to any of the others that are in existence? I think there are only three states.
I think it's different in some respects and the same in others, and I really don't know.
Whether any of those states have these provisions that has been requested?
I don't know the answer. But I think that what we're doing is making it clear so that if there is somebody who has to figure out what this means, they can do that without changing the intent of it.
Well, the reason I ask is because I would presume that there has been some experience with some of those states. Do they have this problem, or is this something that they already have in their law? That was the reason why I asked the request.
I'm just anticipating that this is going to come up, because the lawyer for the manufacturer is going to come in and say it's presumed, but what does that mean? Can we try to fight over that, or is it just conclusive that if you have the four returns or the four times the vehicle can't be repaired in the 30 days in the shop, that's the end of it? Or can you go to court and fight over whether that should really be the end of it? And if you say conclusive, then you know that's the end of it. Now, I won't talk about the business day thing, because I think Osberg covered that, but I would like to talk about the attorney's fees. I think in the long run, that the more that if you provide for attorney's fees, you're actually going to prevent lawsuits. And I know that on his face sounds outrageous.
Coming from an attorney, that sounds like a suspect.
I'll tell you why. The types of statutes that provide for attorney's fees are in these situations, like with liens and bounced checks, and as the legislative counsel indicated, $2,500 or less warranty problems, small tort claims, I think $200. And the whole idea of providing for attorney's fees is that if you have a small claim like that, the person brings the claim, the wealthy defendant just fights it and puts it off, and the consumer then never brings the claim because you know it'll cost more to go to court than just to drop the thing. So what happens, though, when you provide for attorney's fees in a bill like this, the manufacturer knows that if they raise spurious defenses, if they try to fight the thing when they shouldn't, they're going to end up paying for doing that. So if you provide for attorney's fees, the case will never get to court because the manufacturer will say, okay, I can count to 30. This car's been in the shop 30 days, or it's been out of use 30 days. I know this car is covered by the Lemon Law. I have to refund the money or replace the car. There's never going to be a lawsuit. And that's why if the standards are clear and you have the attorney's fees provision, you actually prevent the lawsuit.
Can I interject? You know, that works the opposite, too, because I've been in small business a long time, and it gets to be the point where the attorney's fees and the cost of court cases is sometimes easier to just forget and forgive up. And in small business, we're talking about forgive maybe a debt or something like that, because that really mounts up. So I think it works, in all fairness, it works both ways.
Well, what I'm saying is that if you say that, then the consumer's never going to be able to get the money back, and is never going to be able to get a new car, because there won't ever be a case, even if the law is clearly violated. And one reason that, just as an example, in the bounced check cases, one reason there is an attorney's fees provision is to protect the small business person, so it's worthwhile to try to get your money back from the person who bounced the check.
One I just got one more. But don't you think perhaps that if you're going to take that project on, that should be a larger project and maybe not even part of this bill, if you're going to be looking at that? Because then if you believe in that philosophy, then you're looking at all the laws in the state. And maybe that should be something dealt with in judiciary as far as what the needs are with the consumer, like Representative Jones brought up before.
The reason I think that there might be something to do, but I think that when you have a, I think the idea with this bill is to provide very clear standards. We must get a call a week from someone who has a car that's clearly a lemon. We tell the person we can't handle the case because you can't afford to.
You get a call a week from a lemon?
I
don't believe that.
Oh, I can, if I would document them, I could. Absolutely.
Well, okay, we have to go on with this bill, so you want to add some more to that?
Just a few things.
Because you almost have used up your time.
One of the things on the attorney's fees, and I'll work backwards, on version 7, there's an amendment, or section 6A has been added. And that's for the attorney's fees. It's been our experience, and in our previous testimony, I alluded to the fact that my wife and I received over 2,000 telephone calls in about a 90-day period where we're unable to do anything to include Christmas shopping or try to build houses. I'm a home builder, or work in the National Guard. I'm a battalion commander. It's taken away all of our free time. Those calls were not limited to just diesel problems with GM diesels, nor to 200 series transmissions. We've had calls from people across the board that have had problems with their cars, from steering defects throughout, and I can verify that we're still getting at least one call a week with people that have defective automobiles that have not been able to engage attorneys or getting satisfactory recourse from the dealers, and the dealers are caught in the middle in this issue. And I'm not after the dealers. All we're really after is a product that will reasonably perform the mission for what it was intended for the amount of monies we spent. And we have not gotten that. The corporations are not being abused by the consumer in this issue. We feel that the consumers are being abused by large corporations, by their failure to address the product failures.
You have a question?
Yes, I do. And Mr. Campbell, you were obviously at the